I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This morning's news brings us reports of heavy bombing in Fallujah and a shooting incident in Gaza which threatens the former Palestinian prime minister. These two flashpoints are being intensely followed by people in Arab and Muslim states, and in both cases, the U.S. is at the center of this scrutiny. And in news coming to us just this hour, State Department officials are also confirming that the U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell has submitted his resignation to U.S. President George Bush. In fact, there may be further resignations as the day goes on. These are the headline events that today drive and will continue to dominate U.S. foreign policy. And here's what's also new. Arab states and Muslim leaders from Iran to Yemen, Syria, Saudi Arabia are all now adjusting to the fact that George W. Bush will be around for another 4 years. So today we're taking that slogan, 4 more years, literally, and applying it to U.S. and Arab and Muslim relations. There's not likely to be a great shift in the Bush administration's overall policy. Colin Powell's replacement has not yet been named. So does it mean that Arab and Muslim leaders need to find a new way to talk to Washington, or should we all expect another 4 years of confrontational language? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm going straight to the two gentlemen who will be with us for the balance of the hour. Rami Khoury is executive editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon. He's here in the United States this week as a global studies fellow at Mount Holyoke's Center for Global Initiatives. And he's joining us from a studio in Amherst. Hi, Rami.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. And Ray Takei is joining us from NPR Studios in Washington. He is a senior fellow of Middle Eastern Studies at the Center on Foreign Relations in Washington. Ray, it's nice to have you back as well.
Thanks. That's actually Council on Foreign Relations.
What did I say? Oh, Center. You're right. I'll make that correction. I wanted to start with you, if I could, Ray, on
sure.
This news of the resignation. How is Powell's resignation going to be seen? Let's start with that.
Well, I would suggest that this was largely anticipated, that Secretary Powell was not going to stay for another term of the Bush administration. So in that sense, it fulfills expectations as opposed to generate some sort of a unanticipated controversy. Now, Colin Powell was one of the few members of the administration that believed in multilateralism, diplomacy, and so on. But he was also one of the least effective. Mm-hmm. So his departure, in a sense, may remove a voice for more diplomatic resolutions to conflicts and working with allies and seeking international consensus. But, I mean, it's important to recognize that it was a feeble voice and not particularly one that impacted core policies of the administration.
Rami Khoury, your perspective from Beirut, looking through the Middle East, do you agree with Ray that while he had that status as being somewhat other from the Bush administration, he was never very good at articulating that?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And from the vantage point of the Middle East or the Arab world, certainly, I would say that when we look at the United States, we see three foreign policies coming out of Washington. One is the traditional conservatives, one is the neoconservatives, and the third one is the Powell, slightly more enlightened multilateral members of the administration. And those three different foreign policies were often in clashing with each other, and Powell certainly was the weakest. If his resignation is a sign that we're now going to have foreign policy in the U.S. run by the neoconservatives and the traditional conservatives, that is a cause for great concern around the world, and we're seeing that that concern expressed not just in the Middle East, but really in the entire world. So we'll have to see how this plays out.
Well, perhaps a cause for concern, Rami, but on the other hand, maybe a clearer understanding of what to expect from Washington if there aren't those different perspectives all coming at the same time.
Well, yes, clarity is a good thing at one level, so it's nice to know exactly what the foreign policy of the United States is going to be, but that kind of clarity generates a lot of concern around the world and even some fear. People are worried that the United States is going to rely more on its neoconservative-driven foreign policy, regime change, preemptive war, threatening people, and it's important for people in the United States to understand, whether they like to hear this or not, that in fact, in the eyes of the whole world, the United States is a rogue regime, is a rogue state. While the U.S. is trying to say that North Korea and Iran and Syria and others are the rogue states, the reality is, in the global perspective, the U.S. is the one that stands out from the global consensus. Now, hopefully this is something that the American administration, now Bush administration, their second term, will assess, and to see how the second administration, now second term administration, can engage the world more clearly, hopefully to work for goals that are shared: democracy promotion, resolving conflicts, stopping weapons of mass destruction proliferation. These are goals that all of us share. So we have to hold out the hope, and we really should work to engage the United States in this direction.
Let's bring in another voice here. Massimo Calabrese is joining us on the line. Massimo is diplomatic correspondent at Time magazine. Hi, Massimo.
Hi.
I'm not sure, what do you think of Rami's assessment that the U.S. is seen as a rogue state?
Well, I think it's important to define what we mean by that. Typically, the idea of a rogue nation has been used rhetorically to indicate a violation of international law. International law, it's worth remembering, is a relatively squishy thing. It's not like domestic law, where it's very clear what the law is and how it should be enforced. But nevertheless, international law, there is a body of real international law. And so when people have used the phrase rogue nation in the past, it's tended to be, at least in part, with regard to a country like North Korea violating its international obligations, its treaty obligations. In the case of North Korea, this was particularly the case with its nuclear program. They kicked out IAEA inspectors, violated the terms of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And that's when it really was brought in. So now you can make an argument that in the last 4 years, the United States has violated international law. There are a couple of cases where either the prosecution of the war in Iraq, the abuse of prisoners there, and some other cases where people would say that the U.S. has violated its treaty obligations. I think it's not cut and dried. It's not 100% clear.
Massimo, I wonder if I can turn your attention to what happens next, though. Colin Powell, no longer Secretary of State, has submitted his resignation. Lots of speculation about Condoleezza Rice assuming that role. What do we know right now?
Well, we don't know who's going to replace Colin Powell, to be blunt. There is a lot of speculation. The names that are out there are indeed Condi Rice. She's very close to the president. She knows all the players on all the big issues, has dealt with them one-on-one, whether it's Sharon or Chirac or the players in the Middle East, the replacements to Yasser Arafat. She knows them very well. It might be somewhat surprising if she accepted it, though, after seeing the rough time that Colin Powell had at the State Department. It's been a while since the State Department has been a powerful agency,
right,
in U.S. foreign policy, as much as it might be. Powell had a lot of trouble standing up to Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld on policy matters. So it might not look terribly attractive to her. I'm sure they'd love to have her take it if she would. The other name that's been out there is John Danforth, former senator from Missouri, who's the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. But I'm not sure that he would want to walk into that either.
Any idea when we'll know the answers to who the replacement is? I expect today, but simply because that happened in the case of John Ashcroft's resignation last week. What's your best guess, Massimo?
Well, the administration has shown itself to be quite organized about this, it seems that with the case of Ashcroft and other changes, that they've been ready to move. So I imagine you're right. We will start hearing some names come out in the next day or two, and perhaps even know by definitively by the end of the week. But we'll have to see. There might be reasons why, say, wanting not to undercut Powell, that they would keep it on hold. for a little while.
All right, Massimo, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Massimo Calabrese, diplomatic correspondent at Time magazine. Just a reminder, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. In part, taking a look at the just-announced resignation of Secretary of State Colin Powell, but also what it's going to mean for U.S. foreign policy moving ahead in relations with Arab and Muslim leaders. And Ray Take, I want to come back to that because I think that's a kind of crucial way that the U.S. foreign policy is going to be measured in the years ahead. I was talking with Rami Khoury about at least perhaps being a little bit more clarity without the confused message. Do you see it that way?
Well, in a sense, it depends on who succeeds Colin Powell as the Secretary of State. However, I think it's important to recognize that the president is who he is, and he has a certain set of convictions and beliefs, and the vice president is who he is. And therefore, whomever becomes the Secretary of State has to contend with the president's perceptions, which are black, white, up, down, and so on. And ultimately, the policy of the administration is going to be set by the president, perhaps significantly influenced by his vice president. So if a Secretary of State comes into his office in contradiction of the president's values and convictions, then I think he'll have experience not that dissimilar to the one of Colin Powell, mm-hmm. namely an isolated figure increasingly on the margins of the administration. So in that particular realm, I would suggest that I don't anticipate significant changes in policy given the president's predilections and given vice president's predilections and so on.
And Rami Khoury, to what extent do you suppose in Damascus and in Saudi Arabia and in Iran and in the states that are busy trying to figure out how they're going to relate to the U.S. over the next 4 years, to what extent are people, leaders in those places saying to themselves, maybe we need to adjust, shift policy, find a way of working with these people?
I think there are many people in these countries who are saying that, but probably very few of them are in the regimes, unfortunately, because one of the great problems we've had is if people are concerned about the policies coming out of Washington, there's, I think, more concern in the Middle East by the almost total lack of clarity or even coherence coming out of the Arab regimes, the Syrians, the Saudis, the Egyptians. Most of these regimes have been profoundly ineffective in either understanding the reality of American foreign policy in the region now that it's changed in the last 3-4 years, or in engaging American diplomacy in any constructive way. So I think this has been a real catastrophe for the Arab world, the mediocre leadership and the lack of diplomatic initiatives. Most of these regimes are terribly dependent on the U.S., or, as in the case of the Syrians, they're completely confused about how to deal with the U.S. in many cases. So it's a real problem, and I think we need to look at the mediocrity in the Arab leaderships as well as the aggressive regime change type policy coming out of Washington. Both of those are problems. And, of course, the Israelis, the foreign policy is the third foot of the stool that has to be looked at. So there's great concern everywhere you look, I think, in terms of foreign policy making.
All right, Connection listeners, a quick recap now. Secretary of State Colin Powell has submitted his resignation. It has been accepted by President Bush. No word yet on who his replacement will be. But with the Bush administration heading into its second term and assuming a Secretary of State who is going to be a little bit more in sync with the President and the Vice President, we're asking whether or not Arab and Muslim leaders need to find a new way to talk to Washington, or whether or not we should expect another 4 years of confrontational language and criticism. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. How can the United States and Arab and Muslim leaders find some common ground to talk seriously about peace in the Middle East, to plan ahead for elections in Iraq, particularly as we watch news today of the heavy bombing in Fallujah, also stories of insurgent activity elsewhere in Iraq? On top of that, a little bit of uncertainty into the mix today with the resignation of Colin Powell. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this conversation. I understand the speaker's point that much of the rest of the world does not agree with American position, but to use the term rogue state in conjunction with both North Korea and the United States in the same sentence is really over the top. It's rather an offensive comparison.
I think it's worth looking at it in terms of perception, Steve. And I'm not going to speak for Rami here. I'm going to let him in here. But whether or not the perception of people in some of those Arab and Muslim countries is that the U.S. is behaving like a rogue state. Is that where it comes from, Rami?
Yeah, I mean, of course, in reply to Steve, I would say I don't mean it literally that it is exactly the same kind of rogue state as, say, North Korea or others are accused of being. What I'm saying is that in the perception of the vast majority of the entire world, remember, we're not talking about just a couple of nutty Middle Eastern countries here. We're talking about the entire world, basically, sees the United States as acting outside the norms of a global consensus rooted in both law and morality. You know, when the U.S. does regime changes by itself, using its armies, using its army and its military forces, it did it in Iraq. It did a half regime change in Palestine with isolating Arafat with the Israelis. This is seen to be outside the global norm, and that's what I mean by rogue state. I don't mean it literally.
I agree. The United States also did it in Serbia while the rest of Europe sat by. So it's a very complicated issue. And I think that perhaps the United States could have done a better job of advocating its moral case. I think a good moral case can be made for the United States' actions. It seems that the fact that the United Nations did not act for so long after so many repeated violations is an issue that needs to be explored further, but without going into the whole justification of the war. But I sincerely hope that the rest of the world doesn't think that the term rogue nation is an appropriate term. Otherwise, I would think that their thinking is a little bit too shallow.
Steve, I don't want to get too stuck on that. I think I take Rami's point there in terms of the clarification, and thank you for your call. I wanted to widen the conversation, though, just a little bit. Ray Take, your area of expertise, or one of your areas of expertise, is Iran, and there is a news story from Tehran today suggesting that maybe there is a deal that where the Iranians would freeze their nuclear programs in exchange for a promise or some immunity from UN sanctions. Do we look at that as a sign of possible progress ahead?
This is the second European deal that has been enacted with the Islamic Republic. The first one was October 2003, where Iran pledged to cease uranium enrichment activities in exchange for European states granting it trade concessions and political assistance and making his case in the IEA and so on. That particular deal fell apart simply because the contents of the deal, particularly the technological contents, were ambiguous. In a sense, what does it mean to stop enrichment of uranium? We know enrichment of uranium. Does that mean that you cannot complete construction of centrifuge machines? Does that mean you cannot convert yellowcake into a gas that would subsequently be used for enrichment purposes? So if this particular deal is similarly ambiguous and vague in terms of its technical components, then what happens is all parties interpret it in their own way, and often there's a conflict and tension between those interpretations, and the deal falls apart.
So do you not attach much importance to it at this stage then?
Well, I'm just unaware of the specifics of this deal, whether it is more encompassing, whether it's more specific, whether it is more exact. But ultimately, I don't believe that Iran's proliferation tendencies can be resolved in negotiations between the Europeans and the Iranians without an active participation of the United States.
I guess what interests me in context of the larger conversation here is that we will hear from the Bush administration that their bold and forward policy in Iraq has already led to an agreement by the Libyans not to pursue their nuclear program, that they may mark Iran as part of that success and push forward on that basis. Is there good reason to do that?
There has certainly been the contention of the administration that by playing good cop, bad cop, with Europeans being the good cop and the Americans the bad cop or the stronger cop, that that would give further incentive for Iranians to come to some sort of an arrangement. I'm not quite sure if that's actually the case. I think Iranians were concerned about prospects of multilateral sanctions and about the prospects of this issue being deliberated in the Security Council. And Europeans were concerned about this issue being transferred to the Security Council because this whole debate is being informed by the Iraq proposition, namely that the United States would use Iran standing in violation of its Security Council resolution as a pretext for its own unilateral military action. So all the parties involved had an incentive to have some sort of an interim arrangement that gets them past the next IAEA meeting in November, with the possibility that this deal may fall apart in spring, and once again you revisit the issues.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our next call from Pelham, New Hampshire, and Jamal is on the line. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Fine. You've got a question for Rami?
I do. We've heard a lot of talk now with the death of Arafat that a opportunity may be presenting itself for a settlement with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And my question is, haven't we heard this before time and time again? And it brings sort of my thoughts back to 1988 in Algiers when the Palestine National Council had officially accepted Israel's right to exist, something that, you know, the PLO had actually done dating back to the late 70s, but certainly more formal in Algiers. Then there appeared to be another opportunity for a settlement after the first Gulf War, when the Arab states and the PLO was weakened and the Madrid conference occurred, and then another opportunity back in 1993.
Let's jump it ahead to right now and let Rami in here. Rami, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the opportunity is there, but it's not related to the death of Arafat. The opportunity is there if the three main parties, which is the Palestinians, the Israelis, and the United States, those are the three key parties. Everybody else is supporting caste, Europe, the UN, the Arab countries, Russia, etc. If the Israel, the U.S., and the Palestinians decide that they want to push the peace process forward, they can do so. Arafat is... we should not confuse personality with policy, and this applies to Colin Powell resigning or any of these situations. The policies of the U.S., the Israelis, and the Palestinians are driven by certain forces, constraints, realities, opportunities, etc., and those have not changed at all on the Palestinian side. If Arafat is there or not, I don't expect any significant change in Palestinian policies. I think there is an opportunity
Excuse me for interrupting, Rami. You say you don't expect any significant change. Does that mean a continuation of the armed struggle?
No, I think it's the same situation we've had for probably 4 or 5 years now, which is a kind of a foot race between the militants who want to keep up the armed struggle against the Israeli occupation or the people who want to try to achieve Palestinian statehood and liberation through diplomatic goals. The challenge for Israel, the U.S., and the Palestinian leadership is to show both the Israelis and the Palestinians that they can achieve their legitimate rights, security, statehood, recognition, etc., achieve those rights through a diplomatic process. That has never happened in any significant way since that brief interlude between 1993 and 1995 when the Oslo process started. So I think everybody is looking around now to try to figure out how do we use this moment when there is a new Palestinian leadership taking place. But you're not going to see significant new Palestinian policies or Israeli policies. If the Israelis and the Palestinians both decide that they're going to adjust their policies, then yes, this is going to be a historic opportunity for a breakthrough. But the Israelis have to stop assassinating people and expanding settlements, and the Palestinians have to control their militants, and both of them have to do this simultaneously. It cannot be seen to be the responsibility of one side.
And Ray, one of your observations has been that the U.S. has an opportunity now for some kind of realignment by working with, be seen to be working more with the Palestinians.
Well, the interesting aspect of the recent events in Israeli-Palestinian arena is that for a long time there has been, at least in the Bush administration, a close intimacy between the president and Prime Minister Sharon. And Prime Minister Sharon has been very effective in conflating America's war on terrorism with Israeli policies against the Palestinians. They have always come together in a sort of a, they've been co-joined together. And now, potentially, there could be some degree of differences between the Bush administration and the Sharon government, potentially. Now, when the president gave his press conference with Prime Minister Blair, his terms for the settlement of the conflict didn't actually change. The onus was still on the Palestinian leadership. He demanded transparency, accountability, democracy, and a cessation of terrorist operations and so on and so forth. So once again, when he was asked whether a precondition for the peace process would be Israeli cessation of settlement activities in the West Bank, he actually did not choose to answer that question. And if those parameters remain the same, once again, I think the burden for moving this ball forward is going to be on the Palestinians, and rather exclusively on the Palestinians. And that may actually, once again, take us backward as opposed to forward. Ultimately, I think Israeli policy under Sharon government has been to, and Rami can speak on this more authoritatively than I can, has been to withdraw from Gaza in order to sanctify settlement expansion in the West Bank. And at least from my perspective, I don't see Prime Minister Sharon giving up settlements in the West Bank. So therefore, if this process is going to move forward, the critical actor is not necessarily the United States, but the Israelis themselves, whether they have to elect a new leadership. Sharon was elected as a war prime minister, not a peace prime minister. And if there's a realignment in Palestinian politics or American perceptions, then there has to be, if you would, a change of regime in Jerusalem.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Raleigh, North Carolina again. And Mohammed's with us. Hi, Mohammed. Hey, Mohammed, are you there? No, we seem to have lost that call. I'm going to just jump ahead here to Norfolk, Virginia. And Don should be on the line from there. Hi, Don.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for having me. Yeah. I know that you don't want to focus on the rogue nation definition that we heard earlier in the show, but I just like to say that I believe we are a rogue nation. I think it's very appropriate to describe us as such, and I believe that with Secretary Powell's resignation, that perception of it being a divider and conquer that we are, the U.S., perception that most of the rest of the world has, will not dissipate. It will only be strengthened.
So Don, if we're asking the question as we are this hour about what happens in relations between Arab leaders, Muslim states, and the U.S. over the next 4 years, are you saying just more of the same, only worse?
Precisely. I'm sorry to have such a pessimistic view, but I don't see any future under this administration that we're currently under in terms of international relations with anybody, much less the Arab world.
Well, perhaps I should suggest that maybe Rami can make a concession to American sensibilities and change his name from rogue state to what Madeleine Albright called the state of concern.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the basic point is that, and surveys have clarified this over the last 3-4 years very consistently all over the world, that there is a global concern about the foreign policy behavior of the United States. But there's a way, I think this is a moment to reassess all of these trends. I think we need to be nuanced, a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more hopeful and merciful, perhaps, and forgiving that, okay, we have great concerns and criticisms of American foreign policy in the Middle East, but what are we talking about here? We're talking about an American foreign policy that has done regime changes now in Afghanistan, Iraq, and half a regime change in Palestine when it ostracized Arafat. There's an occupation of Iraq, but there's also elections coming up now. Let's focus on the elections in Iraq and Palestine. There was just an election in Afghanistan of mixed validity, apparently, but Iraq and Palestine are opportunities now. If the United States really applies a consistent policy, does promotion of democracy and the rule of law consistently across the board, honors the applicability of UN resolutions as embodying the international moral and legal consensus, and demands that all UN resolutions be implemented consistently and puts its diplomatic and political support behind that, the U.S. can turn around the situation. Most of the people in the world want to be friends with the U.S. They want to emulate many of the American political values. So I think there is an opportunity for the Bush administration to rethink and recalibrate foreign policy, and I would say focus on the elections in Iraq, in Palestine. Do honest, real elections, and let this be. Iraq is not going to be the model of democracy in the region, but Palestine certainly can be in the Arab world. And if the U.S. were to push for that, I think it would be a tremendous possibility that should be explored. But it is going to require, as Ray said, a significant change in policy in Israel. And I think that's where we need to keep our focus, not the Americans, not the Arabs, but what is going to happen in Israeli society.
Ray, let me, if I can, though, ask you to turn your attention specifically to what's going on in Iraq. We're looking at what the U.S. military calls a sort of wrap-up phase with the attack in Fallujah, but at the same time, signs that the insurgency is popping up in a number of other areas inside and outside the Sunni triangle. I mean, it leads you to thinking that the only way the U.S. will be able to bring a measure of calm to that country in advance of elections will be to bring in a lot more troops. And I don't know whether or not this administration is in any way committed to that. Is that going to be the measure that people will use to say just exactly how much does the Bush administration really want to have those elections in January?
If you look at the footage coming out of Fallujah, it sort of eerily reminds you of the historical footage of the Vietnam War, when American forces had to destroy a city in order to save it. Now, this has all the makings of that type of a counterinsurgency tactics and campaigns, where the United States wins an immediate battle, pacification of Fallujah, only to see an intensification of the insurgency elsewhere, whether it's Ramadi, whether it's Mosul, or what have you, and potentially return of the insurgents to the place that was pacified originally. This insurgency is growing, it's intensifying, and I don't think it's fair or even realistic to suggest that this is a Sunni uprising. Mm-hmm. It is a Iraqi nationalistic rejection of the occupation. That resistance at time takes form of military expressions, as it has most directly in the Sunni triangle, or it takes a form of passive non-compliance, as you see in various Shi'i strongholds. There has always been two options in terms of dealing with Iraq. One was the Howard Dean, Ralph Nader option of withdrawal. The other has been the President Bush's policy of sort of a continuation with the military program in the hope of breaking the back of the insurgency and eventually restoring some degree of political stability. There was never the John Kerry option of internationalizing the conflict.
All right, I'm going to stop you. I want to stop you right there, but I think it's an excellent place to leave it, give us something to think about over the break, because Egypt's Prime Minister Hosni Mubarak is planning on bringing world leaders together later this month to talk about ways of perhaps involving other countries, or perhaps not. There needs to be, perhaps, a signal from the United States. Your thoughts on the change in relations between the U.S. and Arab and Muslim leaders at this critical point, particularly given today's news, the resignation of Secretary of State Colin Powell. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour, Ray Takei. He's a senior fellow of Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Joining us from there, Rami Khoury is executive editor of The Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon, happens to be in the U.S. this week as a global studies fellow at Mount Holyoke Center for Global Initiatives. He's joining us from a studio in Amherst, Mass. And Rami, maybe I can just start with you. I don't know whether or not you attach a great deal of significance to Mubarak's plan to draw together leaders and talk about the future of the Middle East. But it gets to something we were discussing a little bit earlier in the program, whether or not, in fact, those Arab states that claim to have a good working relationship or have had a good working relationship with the United States have a greater role to play here. Egypt, the Jordanians, the Saudis, what do you think?
I think, unfortunately, the modern history of collective pan-Arab action has been unimpressive. There has been very little that has come out of any kind of regional summitry. They've tried this before on, if you remember, on terrorism, Arab-Israeli peacemaking, economic development, human development issues. Virtually every important issue in the Middle East has been subjected to some kind of summitry, either among the people of the region or with the Israel and the United States. And it has always gotten nowhere, unfortunately. And I think one of the problems is, and we're seeing this very clearly now in Iraq, is that most of the leaderships have very fickle, whimsical and erratic legitimacy in the eyes of their own people, let alone in the eyes of anybody else. So we have a real structural problem in leadership in the Middle East. And I think this is one reason why elections are such a critical element, is to start rebuilding legitimacy, or perhaps for the first time generating legitimacy among Middle Eastern leaderships. So I don't expect anything significant to come out of the meeting in Egypt, unfortunately.
And Ray, if there were to be some kind of opening created here where, I don't know, maybe Dutch soldiers or Ukrainian soldiers could be persuaded to take part in what's going on in Iraq, could that create enough of an open door for Mubarak to say, okay, I'm gonna let a division of Egyptian soldiers be a part of peacemaking in Ramadi? Is that all fantasy?
I'm not quite sure if Iraqis want Egyptian soldiers. That's
okay, fair enough.
That's sort of the first issue of concern. Yeah. Second of all, I don't anticipate the United States to be able to generate occupation forces from democratic states, particularly European states, for two specific reasons. Number one, the dirty little secret is Europeans don't have that many additional forces, peacekeeping forces. The one country in Europe that does have them are the French. And our relations with France, to say the least, are tense. Second of all, if the public opinion in European countries, whether it's Germany, whether it's Poland, whether it's new and old Europe, are so dramatically against the continuation of the military campaign in Iraq, it is hard for any elected democratic politician to be able to compel that, to be able to embark on that course of action. And Spain is one model, and the declining political fortunes of Tony Blair are the other one. So you have a position where it's just difficult for United States to be able to generate international support. The one place where you can generate foreign troops would be from countries that frankly rent foreign troops, such as Bangladesh and so on. And that's why, if you recall, last year Don Rumsfeld made a trip to Bangladesh, and he was rebuffed even there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where these international troops are going to come from. Even if you manage to get international troops from countries such as Bangladesh, they're unlikely to be deployed in places where there is significant military conflict, because that would make it politically untenable if the soldiers from those countries are going to come back in body bags. So they would have to be in places such as guarding the library in the Green Zone. They're not going to be patrolling Fallujah. Nobody wants to get to Fallujah or other centers of insurgency. That is always going to be an American military operation, even in the context of greater internationalization of the conflict.
Okay, back to our callers to Columbia, South Carolina. Ian's on the line. Hi, Ian.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine. What's your question?
The guest, what he thought our current policy in Iraq is anywhere. Does the rest of the Middle East feel the ousting of Mohammad Mossadegh in the 50s and U.S. foreign policy up until now, that we have any legitimacy in the eyes of the Muslim people? And does he honestly think that, you know, our unilateral thinking through this process is going to really solve anything?
Let me just turn it slightly, if I can, if you don't mind, Ian, here. That's the question of whether or not, under any circumstances, Rami, the United States could make a case that it's genuinely in the business of promoting democracy and have anyone in the Middle East buy into that.
The answer is yes, it could, if it applied a consistent policy, if it rooted and anchored that policy in the rule of law, in a global morality, moral consensus and political and legal consensus, which is there in the UN Charter and other mechanisms. But yes, the United States could be embraced eagerly by people all over the Middle East and all over the world, as it was in the early 60s and the Kennedy years. The United States was seen as a great beacon of hope in the region. I remember traveling around the Middle East as a teenager in the early 60s and seeing pictures of President Kennedy in grocery stores in Beirut and Egypt and Jordan.
Okay, well, take us from where we are now to 4 years ahead, and whether or not that there's any space for that kind of turn to be made.
It can be made if, you have to remember, how did we get here? We got here through three, four decades of American and Israeli and Arab policy decisions that have created this great, not only anti-American and anti-Israeli sentiment in the Arab countries, but people who are critical of their own regimes in the Arab countries. So we get out of here by moving forward, sort of retracing our steps. Having consistency, I think, is the single most important suggestion I would make. A consistent American policy that is rooted in the rule of law. So promote democracy everywhere. End occupations everywhere. Implement UN resolutions everywhere. Work with the people in the region on the basis of the principle of the consent of the governed. That governments who speak in the name of Arab people should have the legitimacy and support of their own people. Those are vague principles that I'm talking about, but they can be applied in, one by one. Afghanistan is a fascinating example. Kosovo, another one, of how the Northern Ireland, where the U.S. was involved in a process that was rather coherent and maybe controversial, but it did try to apply these principles clearly. And I think we can get back to a situation where the United States is seen as a credible partner to deal with, but it has to stop applying double standards, whether it's weapons of mass destruction proliferation, occupations, rule of law, UN resolution, implementation. In all these areas, the U.S. is criticized because it applies double standards, and that has to stop. If it doesn't stop, then we'll just have more beheadings and more of the same.
Back to Raleigh, North Carolina for another call from another Mohammed. Hi there.
Hey. I just have one point that I don't see anyone is mentioning. If we look at United States policy, the only winning card and the most sympathetic have in the world, Arab world, is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. If we look deep, we can't see that United States is interested in solving this problem. Because if they're trying to apply anything in the Middle East, the first thing they're going to talk about is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And they know that this is a winning card for them.
Why are you saying, Mohammed, that the United States is not considering this? I mean, U.S. leaders in the past have taken this very seriously. President Bush was saying on Friday that he acknowledges he now only has 4 years to turn his attention to it, says he's going to work at it. Why are you so pessimistic?
Okay, I'm not pessimistic. It's like serious, but not serious enough. They need this conflict always to be in the, like, not in the headline, but it's not final resolution. Why? Because if the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is gone from the Middle East, the next thing any United States trying to apply, they are not going to have the great support. Because let's admit that once they have the Israeli conflict, there is no conflict in the Middle East. If we look at the United States policy when they started the war in Iraq, they were so interested in solving the Israeli-Palestinian.
Let's hear what Ray Takeh has to say about this. I know Rami has spoken on this program before about that kind of shift in U.S. thinking as being a key to perhaps re-engaging Arab and Muslim leaders. Do you see it the same way, Ray?
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is an extraordinarily important and serious conflict, and its perpetuation has had a corrosive impact on Arab body politic. However, it is important to recognize that some of the things that Rami was saying, that the problems of Middle East transcend the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They have to do with the crisis of governance, regimes that are unaccountable and unrepresentative and self-perpetuating. They have to do with the demography of the region that is overwhelming its resources. They have to do with double-digit inflation and unemployment rate. They have to do with the fact that the governments of the region are incapable of meeting the essential and basic demands of their constituencies. There is a sort of institutional stagnation. And those problems are not going to go away if there is a peace that is successful between Israelis and Palestinians tomorrow. And for too long, the Arab leaders have cynically pointed out to the peace process and lack of it to justify the deficiencies of their own rule. There has to be some sort of a change within individual governments, within individual societies.
I can imagine one of the people in the White House right now saying, well, gee, Ray, that's exactly what we did in Iraq. We couldn't make any progress in trying to reform Saddam Hussein, so this was our other alternative.
Well, the president's assumption in Middle East policy assumption was always that if you change the regime in Iraq, that would have a transformative impact throughout the Middle East. That was always a spurious assumption. And it was as spurious as Clinton administration's assumption, which was the same, except instead of Iraq, you had the peace process.
Right.
Namely, resolution of the peace process would have a transformative effect in the region and would be a catalyst of a new Middle East, in the words of Shimon Peres. A new Middle East can only come about if there are different type of governments in individual Arab countries. No one crisis, whether it's Iraq,
right,
whether it's peace process, can have that sort of a transcendent impact.
All right, let's go back to our callers, to Belmont, Massachusetts, and Nadine's with us. Hi, Nadine.
Yes, hi. I have a question about what's happening in Fallujah to
yep.
Rami Khoury.
Go ahead.
And others. I wonder if the the news about the destruction and what's happening in Fallujah is not becoming a symbol of what the United States represents in the Arab world? And how different is that in the Arab perception from what the Syrians, for example, did in Hama with their airplanes, or what the Israelis did in the Jenin camp?
That's a good question. I think there is, first of all, a distinction made in the eyes and minds and hearts of people around the Middle East that foreign occupations, subjugations, military attacks by, say, Israel or the United States against Arab countries are worse than the same kind of destruction and subjugation done by Arab regimes against their own people. That may be morally unacceptable, but it is a reality. People tend to see the foreign threat from Israel or the United States or European colonialism in the years past, they see the foreign threat as a bigger priority, a bigger problem than the internal grievances that we have against our own leaderships. But I think what's interesting and important now throughout the region, you see this in the Arab countries and Iran, people are now, many people are saying, look, we can't make this distinction, because if we're asking the United States to be consistent and to apply a single standard of morality, we must do the same thing too, that we must condemn dictatorial regimes in the Arab countries who hurt their own people in the same way that we should condemn Israel for its occupation and the U.S. for its occupation in Iraq. So this is a hopeful sign that people are saying that universality of morality, of political systems and values is an important issue, that all human beings are created equal and they must enjoy a single standard of law. But the point that I think is very important to understand, and we saw this in the funeral of Arafat, which I think was fascinating and badly misunderstood by the Western media especially, this tremendous emotion that came out in Arafat's funeral in Palestine and the Arab countries, was related primarily, I think, to the fact that the Palestinian cause is the last active anti-colonial movement in the world that is fighting a colonial movement that started in the late 19th century. The Zionist Israel movement that gave rise to Israel started in the 1890s. Now, of course, Israelis don't see it like that, but most people in the Middle East do, and Arafat was a symbol of this, and the Palestinian cause continues to struggle against historical injustices. And these historical injustices are profound. And Iranians, of course, remember Mossadegh, and many people in the Middle East still complain about the Crusaders and Sykes-Picot and Napoleon's invasion. So this historical memory is a powerful element and will always mean that the foreign military threat and subjugation is greater than the domestic one. So we need to keep those two things juxtaposed.
All right. We are out of time. Rami Khoury, I want to thank you for being with us on the program again.
My pleasure, and let me take this opportunity to congratulate the Boston Red Sox on their victory.
Yeah, we didn't call you on that. I can't believe we didn't. Rami's executive editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon, currently at Mount Holyoke Center for Global Initiatives. Ray Takeh, thanks a lot for your time as well.
Thank you.
Ray's senior fellow of Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Earlier in the program, a couple of words with Massimo Calabresi, diplomatic correspondent at Time Magazine. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.